Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Raj Marito Sinoland. And I've got a great friend on the show today, Peter Koenig. How are you doing?
Thanks, Jeff. I'm fine too. Beautiful. We have hot engineered weather here in Geneva. It is absolutely unbelievable.
Peter and I, I feel like we're just really old friends. He's based in Switzerland and I'm based in Normandy in France, and we've been talking about trying to get together forever, and we will do it one of these days.
We have to, otherwise we have to go back to the US to get together. I spent more than half of my life in the US.
Oh boy. Well, listen, this is not the first time Peter has been on China Rising Radio Sinoland. In fact, I just checked, he's been with us four times now, so this will be the fifth time. And a quick introduction. He is a regular contributor to Global Research, and he's been on fire lately. And we're going to talk about several of the things that he's written about in the last month or so. And he's a geopolitical analyst and a former senior economist at the World Bank for 30 years. He has worked for 8 years in West Africa, France's former colonies, and where I've traveled a lot too, including in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. He knows about the CFA arrangements. Yeah, boy, what a screw job, which can continue making the 14 West and Central African CFA zones dependent on France. They're still colonies. And he lectures at universities in the U.S., Europe, and South America. He writes regularly online journals and is author of Implosion, an economic thriller about war, environmental destruction, and corporate greed, and co-author of Cynthia McKinney's book, When China Sneezes, From the Coronavirus Lockdown to the Global Politico-Economic Crisis, Clarity Press, November 2020. So we're co-authors because I contributed to chapter two. Peter is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization, the CRG. He is also a non-resident senior fellow of the Chongyang Institute of Zhenmin University in Beijing. Chapeau, mon ami. That's pretty impressive. Well, listen, I get Peter's emails, and He has been writing about some stuff that's just beyond belief. It's almost like science fiction. And I wanted him to talk to him about directed energy weapons. Is that right, Peter? They're called
directed. Correct. That's the right term. Yes.
And geoengineering versus hydrocarbons. You know, that we're burning up. We're burning hydrocarbons out of the ground, and climate change. And then, time permitting, we've got a couple of three more that we'd like to talk about. But this is so fantastic, and so it just seems so unbelievable. But then I saw the stuff about Maui, being torched, and what you were writing about makes sense. So please tell us about directed energy weapons and geoengineering.
Well, directed energy weapons is, of course, a science that has been developed during the past at least 30, 40 years, has been perfected and is now in the hands of many countries, of course, the US, but also China and Russia, and probably Iran. I'm not sure about Iran, but most likely also Iran, and maybe some European countries too. Directed energy weapons is actually an electromagnetic beam that is being cast in laser speed onto a target. And this has been very clearly seen in Maui, in Lahaina, when there were actually photographs where you could see the laser beam coming down. That can be done through drones, can be drawn through airplanes, satellites, and so on. So, but in this case, in Maui, it was most likely done by drones or airplanes. So you could see on the pictures, on the videos, how the beams came down onto particular buildings and destroyed them. And the trees were intact. Everything went up in flames, and there were flames on boats, actually. So they destroyed boats on the sea and tried to make believe that this is forest fire. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. 90% of the population in Maui know what it's all about, but they are not allowed to talk, or they, if they are allowed to talk, they're not listened to. What they say is not broadcast anywhere. There is a silence about it. Though it's slowly but surely coming out. There is something very, very strange about it. If you see cars being melted because this heat generated by this directed energy is so strong that it melts glass. It melts glass and iron, but doesn't destroy trees, and it doesn't destroy the tires of the cars. So, you know, there's something absolutely wrong. And I have a picture, beautiful picture. If you want to, I can send it to you.
Please do, and I'll put it in on our article
page. On how the area, kind of a waterfront area of Lahaina, has been totally destroyed. But there is in the middle is a totally untouched red house, which was saved. I don't know to whom it belongs, but it was, I mean, it's a marvel, the picture itself, and it shows actually what is going on. So this is direct energy weapon, which is being applied probably in wars too, or can be applied in wars. Whether it has been done so far, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if Ukraine would try to apply it in some capacity against Russia, although they don't even get close enough to Russia to apply them. But this is directed energy, and this is something that we have to count on, because it's being, as we see in Maui, it's being presented as climate change. You know, forest fires and due to climate change. It's the case for Canada. Canada is basically burning on all sides, and it's the same thing. It's arson and directed energy weapons that lit up the trees and there's particularly the houses between the trees. And this is going on all under the flag of climate change. Climate change is actually much, much worse than COVID. COVID was a first warning. With COVID, they tried to figure out how much can they do with the people. How obedient are we going to be? How does the fear campaign work on us? How does it destroy our immune system, the immune, health immune, but also our resistance, our mental resistance? And it has worked. It has worked perfectly well. And as it has worked, you can bring in a much, much broader weapon. And I call this climate change is a weapon they are using in order to suppress the people. You can do everything you want. You know, we have had here, and I'm just talking about little Switzerland. We have had here during the last weeks or so, we have had temperatures oscillating between 30 and 40 degrees. In Geneva, I think the record was yesterday or day before yesterday, was 39 degrees or something like that. Unheard of, and it's abnormal. Now it's predicted that it will drop by about 10 to 15 degrees centigrades over the weekend. This is also absolutely abnormal. And what it does to benign populations like the Swiss, you know, elderly people will fall sick and may die because if they, you know, these temperature swings are absolutely disastrous for people's health. Now, in other parts of the world, and what I have also written about, for example, in Pakistan, the monsoon, last year's monsoon, lasted almost 3 months and destroyed just about everything. This was not natural. This was done to castigate the people, to punish the people, to bring the people away from trying to bring back
Imran Khan,
and they destroyed their houses, their infrastructure, and their crops. 90% of their crops were destroyed. So, with other words, there's an enormous inflation for those who can still afford imported food, and others will starve. And this is another way of connecting with Agenda 2030 and the Great Reset, namely getting rid of people as much as you can and in any ways possible. The COVID vaccine was one of them, and maybe so far the most efficient one, but anything else will count too. Famine is certainly the next one in line. And you imagine, you know, this has been going on also for quite a while, this climate change. I think it was in 1965 already, 64 or 65. I have a little video of at that time President Johnson talking to a graduation class in somewhere in Texas and telling them, among other things, telling them that the climate can be altered, that weather can be controlled, and that by 2025, that's the figure he mentioned in this video more than 50 years ago, 2025, the US will control the weather and the climate. That's what he said already at that time to a graduation class. Climate modifications have been going on. This is a science that has started in the 1940s. We had last year, at the end of August, about the same time as we are now, it was also very hot in Switzerland. We had a counter WEF meeting in Davos. You know, the WEF usually meets in Davos every January. And this is a friend of mine who organizes a group of people and has a counter WEF also in Davos. And he invites great people to come to this and make presentations on all sorts of issues. One of them was a meteorologist, a professor of the University of Zurich. When he opened his speech, we were a group of maybe 100 people, 120, I forgot, I don't know exactly. But when he opened his speech, he said, "I don't have to tell you that our weather is manipulated and our climate is manipulated. You all know that. I just want to explain to you how it's done." And then he started explaining how it's done, how complex the system is. He rattled down on a TV screen, he rattled down hundreds of patents of smallest particulates of all kinds of chemicals. A prevalent chemical is aluminum, because that has other effects than just the modifying and controlling the weather. But it was mind-blowing what he had to say on how it's done. It's not just chemtrails. It's done now. It's much more sophisticated. You know, we have had HARP that was dismantled, I think, in 2014 or 4 or something in Alaska, dismantled this, but it's now integrated totally in the U.S. Air Force and is actually activated through satellites. You wanted to say something, I think.
Well, it's just unbelievable. Well, now let's take two specific cases, Maui and Canada, because I also read articles by people saying these are being started simultaneously all over Canada, and this is no accident. But who benefits from burning Lahaina to the ground, and who benefits burning up one of Canada's most treasured resources, lumber?
Right. Well, let's start with Lahaina. There's actually a lot of literature or information out there, some of which, or most of which, I've tried to include in my article, and which they wanted to make out of Lahaina, a 15-minute city, a totally digitized city, and buy up the property by the rich people. You can imagine Maui is a paradise. So when all those elite monsters have to retire somewhere, this is one of the places they think they can go. So the real estate is now really cheap. You know, they can buy it. They want to buy it up. I don't know whether the local population will allow it. I've heard actually people speaking out against it, those who understand what's going on. But the idea is that that many will not come back. They went to the mainland maybe or to another island and want to get rid of this burned up real estate and will sell it for a penny to the dollar, you know, and that's what they want. And then rebuild it and make a 15-minute city out of it, but a totally electrified and totally digitized city where people would live, probably eventually also digitized, those that would serve the serfs, you know. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. There are documents about it. They're going to have a meeting about in Hawaii, I think sometime early September. I forgot the exact date, maybe the 9th or the 10th, but it's all in my article that you got a copy of too, all these details. And you will see, so there's a firm plan already in place that has been, I'm sure, that has been planned for years or for decades already. This is not new. What's going to happen or what should happen with Maui and particularly with Lahaina. Now, whether it will, I don't know. And let me say, my attitude towards these things is always it will not happen. Because we have a willpower, we have, we the people, have an enormous power of spirituality. And if we put that together, we can actually avoid stuff like that. People may think that what I'm saying is crazy, I'm a nutcase, maybe I am, but I'm firmly believing that we have the power to avert this crime of biblical proportions, really.
Peter, Lanai, I've been on the island of Lanai in Hawaii, and it was bought. The whole frickin' island was bought by one of the co-founders of PayPal for $900 million, almost $1 billion, and that was a long time ago. And I have read that Oprah Winfrey and other billionaires want Maui to turn it into a billionaires enclave. Have you heard that?
I've read that too. Yes.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Well, I hope the people don't sell. It's interesting. Also, Maui was the capital of the kingdom of Hawaii, and the town that was burned up was where the queen used to live before she was deposed by the U.S. Marines,
right?
In what was it, the late 19th century? I can't quite remember, but Maui is very, shall we say, I think it's pretty clear cut. People are trying to get their claws on Maui for pennies on the dollar, just like Nero did when he burned down Rome. He burned down Rome to make room for his palace, and then he could persecute the Christians and blame them for the fires. And so he was able to kill off several thousand Christians as scapegoats. But why the fires in Canada? Why?
Well, the fires in Canada, I've also seen pictures on how they started simultaneously. So this was, of course, not an accident. You could see there were air photographs, probably taken by drones. You could see in about 10 or 15 places how they started simultaneously, these fires. So it's not just simple arson. It's scientifically planted fire that should destroy and did destroy, I don't know how many thousands of hectares already, or square kilometers, you can better call it. And the reason why, well, one, there are several reasons. One of them is, of course, if the forest is gone, you can always blame it. And this is one of the blames they can clearly say, well, this is climate change. You know, we have had fires every year that I can remember. They have been in southern France, in southern Spain, in Italy, in Greece. There have been forest fires. Most of them were arson already years ago, already decades ago. I've seen helicopters who were sent out there in southern Spain, for example, or in Portugal. I forgot whether it was Portugal or Spain. There were movies about it. You know, a helicopter went with these huge balloons of water to extinguish the fire. But instead of extinguishing the fire, they actually planted more fire with something similar to this directed energy weapon instruments already years ago. That was at least 2 or 3 years ago, or maybe longer. So this has been going on for a long time. Now, you can blame it, of course, on climate change, and that's what they're doing. But in Canada, this is actually very fertile land, and this land can be turned into, you know, Canada.
Okay. Like burning down the... Like burning down the Amazon,
and the forests in Papua New Guinea and all that stuff.
Yeah, okay.
It's Australia's baby. You know, all of that is going on. We don't even know it here, and it's the same thing. You can, it will be for agriculture, for their type of agriculture, to make sure that they have enough food while they are starving us. But you know, this thing is, and again, I must say, it will not succeed. It will actually backfire. I mean, we have at the same times, you know, we have had, today is the last day of this, let me call it arguably the most important BRICS meeting so far in Joburg. And they just decided to add 6 more countries to the BRICS.
BRICS 11. They're now calling it BRICS 11, yeah.
BRICS 11. And this actually, if, I mean, they're so diverse, the countries that I have still, I'm not sure yet how they will coordinate themselves. I mean, they're from the left, the right, the globalists, and everybody is in this BRICS pie. I hope they will be able to coordinate properly and will adhere to the rules that they have to put out. I've also written an article about it. I don't think I've distributed it, but you can find it on Global Research, and may actually add something to it now after I know that it's BRICS 11. But you know, with this strength moving on at the same time in parallel, the BRICS 11 probably have now about, I would imagine, at least 50% of the world population, and probably between 35 and 40% of the world's GDP.
Bigger than the G7. I mean, the G7 is dead now. I mean, the G7 doesn't count.
700 million people. There's nobody.
Yeah, and now the BRICS 11 have a bit more GDP than the G7. Just like the G7 just got totally eclipsed. I mean, it doesn't matter for anything now.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. And I mean, that we know, and probably 70% of the world knows when they get their news. But Western news are so indoctrinated that they still believe the G7's calls the shot on the world. And they may have for a while, wrongly, but this is not going to last. And that's why I say, we, in the end, we are so strong with our mental capacity to be able to generate a different direction, a direction that will save the world, not destroy it. And I think that's what we are going to do, and that's what BRICS is all about. You know, nothing goes without a hitch. I'm sure there are going to be lots of hitches in BRICS. But one of the things that I just read, I also wrote an article about it. It's not published yet, will be probably today or tomorrow, about Argentina, the new elections of Argentina.
Yeah.
Where Milei, you know, this neo-Nazi guy, came out of nobody. He wants to, again, dollarize the country.
And like the Chicago Boys did back in the 90s.
Exactly, like Menem did under the Chicago, the IMF at that point.
And
within 10 years, the country was totally destroyed. And at the turn of the century, 2000, 2001, 2003 or so, I worked very intensely in Argentina. And I saw the disaster life. It was just unbelievable. And this guy wants to do the same thing. He said, actually, I want to do away this, close the Argentina central bank and go straight to the dollar, like Ecuador did in 2001. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable also. Now, Argentina is one of the six countries that have been admitted to.
Yeah, I know, into BRICS, yeah.
And now with Argentina being in the BRICS and one of the priorities, number one, Putin said, Xi Jinping said, it's de-dollarization. You know, we have to find ways. It's not easy. And I know that. I've been 2 weeks in China last month and have had many discussions with people on economic issues. So everybody knows it's not easy, but it has to be done, and they're doing it, and China is doing a great job. Russia is also doing a great job. Russia is, of course, hindered because they still have this, what's her name? A chief of the central bank who is who comes from the U.S. Treasury eventually. You know, she was implanted in 1991 and Putin was unable to get rid of her so far. It's a good question, why not? But I mean, there are threats all over the place, you know that.
Yeah.
So it's not easy for him to get rid of her. But he is gradually replacing her with other important people. And he has been very successful in de-dollarizing the ruble. And eventually, if the ruble in the West collapses to less than a penny to the dollar or whatever it is, or to the euro, it doesn't really matter to Russia because their market is reoriented the same as, to a large extent, already China's.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a new market. BRICS is also going to be a new market, a new orientation for the East, not to depend anymore on the West. West doesn't realize that, but this is what's going to happen. That's behind it all. So you have very strong 11 countries that are now binding together. And I hope that bind will strengthen during the next 5 to 10 years to the point that it will be absolutely unbreakable.
What's really, I think I can remember who they are. Argentina, which has a common border with Brazil, so that's now the second largest economy in South America after Brazil. Then we have Iran, which is, which must be making Israel and the West tremble in its boots that Iran is now a member of BRICS. Then in Africa, we have Egypt and Ethiopia.
Right.
And then two very, very, very wealthy hydrocarbon producers, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So,
Emirates, yes.
So you've got Iran and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, three of the biggest hydrocarbon producers in the world now with Russia.
So you see, Jeff, there are no coincidences. It's not for nothing that Xi Jinping went to Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yeah. Sure, I wrote an article about that.
I wrote also about that. There's no coincidence that he went to Saudi Arabia to ask them to make peace with Iran. Now they're in the same group.
Hopefully yeah.
Be warriors together. I mean, dots connect. That's what I learned in my experience with the World Bank, that there is no dot alone. Everything connects. And so you cannot just talk about Agenda 2030 without talking about the Great Reset and without talking about climate change and the vaccines and everything that is going on in this respect is connected.
Peter, I do want to ask you two more questions about climate change and direct energy weapons. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, about 9 trillion tons of carbon have been released into the atmosphere. Has that had any effect on climate change?
Absolutely zero. Absolutely nothing. Already 20 years ago, I think, when this whole thing with climate change started, of course, with the limits to growth, the Club of Rome, already in the early 70s. And it was gradually pushed forward, imperceptibly to most people. Then there was the first big climate conference, UN climate conference, in 1992 in Rio, remember?
The Rio conference on climate.
And they started with the climate change agenda. And from then on, we have had so far, what, about 27 climate change conferences? And within these conferences, nothing, zero has changed. They talk about measures to reduce the carbon footprint. They talk about measures to reduce hydrocarbon use. You know, in 19, and I followed this very closely because it's part of my analysis on how the world ticks. About 30 years ago, 1990, the world used 87% of all the energy used in the world came from hydrocarbons. You know, 87%. You know how much it is today? It's 85%. So the 2% are well within the margin of error. So actually, nothing has changed. And as I started this 20 years ago, I read from a, I forgot his name, but at that time he was a famous professor, analyst from Australia, who talked and described about the climate change hoax. And he said what humans contribute to the carbon footprint is maybe 0.05% or less. That's what he said. It can hardly be put into figures, and it has no impact whatsoever. Besides, CO2, we need it. Without CO2, there's no life on Earth. You know, and CO2 is absorbed when there's an excess. It's absorbed by the seas. And if there is not enough, because trees and plants need to breathe, and there is not enough, the sea, you know, everything is connected. You know, that's the beauty. That's why linearism doesn't work. That's why digitization will not work. So if the rainforest needs more CO2 because it's their food to create oxygen for the plants and life to live, then the sea releases it. So it's amazing. These enormous quantities of CO2, which is absorbed by the sea and released by the sea according to the needs of Mother Earth. And this is what's going on. Everything else is just, I call it BS, but actually that's too nice a word, because it's a crime what we are doing to humanity and to Mother Earth by claiming that climate change comes from the human footprint. It's absolutely nonsense. But it has been indoctrinated heavily, heavily, heavily for the last 30 years since the climate change conference in Rio, and it's very, very difficult to get that out of the heads of the young people. You know, they will just simply not believe it. They say, you're nuts. Of course, what we are producing is causing the climate change. You know, it goes that far. We have recently seen, we have a TV set which we never watch, except for a few documentaries. And the other day, my wife said, look, there's an interesting documentary on sea life in the North Sea. And so we watched it. It's very interesting as far as animals is concerned. But every second sentence talked about how the North Pole is melting, and how ice bears and all these animals that live there have a hard time to survive because the sea is melting due to climate change, due to climate change, due to climate change, due to climate. You know, this is a kind of an indoctrination. And I told her, well, you know exactly, of course. If they can heat up the Europe to 42 degrees, or Beijing at the time I was in Beijing, we had on average 42 degrees. Can you imagine? They said that there's a record they have never had before. And then a few weeks later, they had floods they have never had before. So if we are able to do these climate changes artificially, You imagine how they melt the glaciers, how they melt the ice pole, the North Pole, the South Pole, whatever they want, they melt it. And it's categorized under climate change. This is a crime. This is a crime of, I don't know what to express it otherwise than saying, of biblical proportions.
Mm. One other one about directed energy weapons. I read that in several articles that what's it been now, 3-4 months ago, maybe 6 months ago, the 9.2 Richter scale earthquake on the border of Turkey and Syria that killed tens of thousands of people and destroyed thousands of square kilometers of habitation. I read articles that it was an abnormal earthquake, that it was like a series of like atomic bombs going off in a string under the ground, and it did not have a focal point, and that people were saying that it was directed energy weapons. Do you think it's possible to do that with DEW?
It's absolutely not only possible, it's very likely. I wrote also an article about it. Because we have no proof, I had to qualify it by putting a question mark behind it. But for me, it is very clear. For Erdogan, it is very clear that this was this is probably the offspring of HAARP. Now I've read actually how it's done. It's complicated to explain just on this show, but it's done by a satellite. They have these beams. You can call them directed energy weapons. It's a beam. It's an electromagnetic beam from satellites that comes like a laser with laser speed and goes down apparently about 17 kilometers into the Earth, and there it explodes. It can be made to explode, because if you look at where the earthquake in Turkey took place. This is one, and the other one which falls into the same category is the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. But let's talk about Turkey. Now, this earthquake was really very well placed right at the border between Turkey and Syria. And there, I've looked on several maps, there were no plates, you know, shifting plates.
Yeah, no tectonic plates.
Tectonics, there are no tectonic plates, nothing. The tectonic plates, which have been causing earthquakes in Turkey earlier, traditionally, are about close to 1,500 to 1,000 kilometers north of where that happened. So it's absolutely has nothing to do with it. So from my point of view, this has been artificially done to call Erdogan to order, to make sure that he sticks to NATO, to make sure that he, you know, he has been making peace with Syria. That's a no-no for the U.S. Because the Turkey being a NATO member and Syria being under steady attack from the U.S., you can't do that. Plus, how he behaves, his relationship with Russia is a no-go for mm-hmm. a NATO mm-hmm. member.
And ordering S-300 air defense missile systems,
exactly. Yeah. And so on. So this was a clear call to Erdogan to watch what he is doing. Now, I think that he has not resigned over it, that he has been actually reelected and sticks. Mm-hmm. It shows that he has character, because the next guy who would come in, he was a vassal of the United States, you know, his opponent, I forgot his name, during the election, he would have been a total puppet for the United States. So it's a good thing that he, for the time being, he is still on. But this earthquake that cost the life probably of 100,000 people, which is a record of never reached in history by an earthquake, never, plus the destruction of infrastructure, of housing, is just so enormous. It will cost years and years for Turkey to recover. Well, they probably get some help from you know whom to rebuild. But it's very clearly you can call that directed energy weapon.
Wow.
Via satellite.
That's scary. Well, let's move on to another couple of, I think we can put these two together. And because since you and I both have a lot of experience in West Africa, I don't want to leave out what's the revolution going on. And it's so inspiring. But tell us quickly about Agenda 2030 and how the World Health Organization supranational treaty, how that's all rolled up into one ball of wax.
Okay, well, you know, the World Health Assembly was supposed to, in May, they usually meet in May. This past May, I think it was the last week of May, they were supposed to vote on this pandemic treaty and the revised international health regulations, the IHR. And the pandemic treaty is an integral part of this revised international health regulation. So they were supposed to vote on it. And the health assembly is made up of representatives of the 194 member countries of WHO. But of course, these delegates, they can be replaced. If a delegate doesn't conform, a country can be asked to send somebody else. They are not necessarily the health ministers. In many cases, they are, but not necessarily. A country can decide to send whoever they want, who makes the cut for WHO. Now, they didn't vote. The strange thing is, and I wrote about that in different articles already, they, surprisingly to me, they didn't vote. Now, I found out why they didn't vote. I suspect very strongly why they didn't vote. Because they knew they need two-thirds of majority in order to get through. They may not have had the two-thirds of majority, and that would have sent a warning signal to the rest of the world. The United States definitely does not want that, particularly the Republican Senate. I mean, there are senators, Republican senators, who have launched already, and this can be found on internet, have launched already motions in Congress to get out of WHO.
Mm-hmm.
If the US would get out of WHO, you can imagine how many others would get out of WHO too. So this was a no-go. Better don't vote now. Now, the other thing is, we have the UN next month, this coming month, pretty soon, within a couple of weeks or so, we have the UN General Assembly going on in New York. And that goes on for about 3 weeks or so. Within the UN General Assembly, they have set aside 2 days, I think it's the 19th and the 20th of September, to talk about the Sustainable Development Goals, actually Agenda 2030. And I suspect that this treaty will be, and the international health regulations will be discussed during these 2 days. And what I suspect may happen is that instead of WHO handling that, because WHO is just another agency of the United Nations, they're not really a UN agency because they were set by Rockefeller, as you know, but they bought into the UN system. Now, if this, and they know that they probably will not go through with it, so they would transfer that responsibility pandemic treaty and the international health regulations somehow under the responsibility of the UN. And then they may be maybe the executing agency or something like that, but under the responsibility of the UN. In order to do that, however, it would need the approval of the Security Council. This is strong enough that it needs the approval of the Security Council. They will not get the approval from the Security Council as it stands today, because there are too many of the five, at least Russia.
Well, you just need one veto.
Exactly, you just need one veto, and they will have at least one veto. So what they have been talking about, and this was just a rumbling talk, I don't think that they have any firm ideas, unless by now they do, that they will have to set up something that is above the Security Council. And one name that was advanced to do that was an emergency, some kind of an emergency platform, which would be above the Security Council, and to have that emergency platform vote on it. But But you can imagine an emergency platform would have to include, that would never come about if it wouldn't include Russia and China, you know, and the United States, of course. So all of this, I think, also is in high suspense and will probably not happen, at least not in the format that we have been told it will happen. You know, my spirits again tell me it will not happen.
That's good to hear, because it would literally, well, already the European, you and I both know, we live in Europe, the European Union, the Lisbon Treaty has completely castrated all the national governments in Europe. They have no power. They get their marching orders from Brussels, from the Eurogroup, and so this would even be worse, because it would be pan-global.
Yes.
And who's in who? Well, the vaccine companies, the big pharma, Bill Gates, George Soros, you know, a lot of really nice people, you know.
The Rockefellers,
just some really humanitarian, you know, organizations and people who have our best interests at heart. So I hope that doesn't happen. Well, tell us about 2030, because I know you mentioned it a lot, but it's a Trojan horse, it seems like. What's it a Trojan horse for?
It's actually to hide what they are carrying out behind this. Is the 2030 is the four in the forefront of the agenda 2030. You have the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and within these 17 goals, you have, I don't know, 186 or so sub-goals. Now, parts of these goals have been included way afterwards by Bill Gates, for example. He can just go and say, hey, open this one, I want to put this in, and it's unbelievable. Now, what is behind these 17 development goals is of course exactly the contrary. For example, one of them, since I work with water, one of them is that everybody should have access to drinking water. Obviously, that's so clear. Obviously, everybody should have access to drinking water. But what that means in reality is drinking water is going to be privatized.
Yeah.
And then you can imagine who will get access to drinking water. And then family life is being promoted. You know, okay, family life, that's all nice, sounds beautiful at the surface. What does it mean? It means that families will have to be decimated to a certain number of members of a family. And all of this, you can go, I have a list actually, which I can send you also.
Please.
Of the interpretation. I think I have it. There's a cover note in English, but then under each one of these goals, the interpretation is in Spanish. But it's easy enough to understand.
Oh yeah, you sent me the English version.
I sent you the English.
Yeah. Somebody sent it to me in Spanish, and then I sent it to you, and then you sent it back to me in English. I'll find it.
Okay, send it to me back in English, because I can't find it anymore. Please.
All right. Well, listen, before we get out of here, because unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, I love teaching my kids in China. I teach online. I teach children online.
What are you teaching? Chinese?
Oh, no. I'm teaching. I teach English, science, geography, geology, you know, any kind of science. You know, I'm certified. I'm certified in a number of, I've also taught French, my Chinese is good, but I'm not a Chinese teacher, that's for sure. But anyway, let's talk about West Africa. I lived and worked in Africa for 10 years and traveled all over that West Africa and East Africa and Southern Africa, and you worked there for years and years and years. Isn't it just amazing what's going on in the Sahel with Guinea and Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger and Chad and the Central African Republic? It's just incredible. Tell us about that.
It is incredible, and I've worked in all of these countries that you just mentioned. During my first stint with the World Bank, I worked mostly in Francophone West Africa, so also in Niger. Niger, of course, is a very special. I like the country very much. It's very close to my heart. Burkina Faso, Niger are the two countries in West Africa that I like the most. For some reason, they have an ambience. Now, Niger has the highest grade of uranium, you know, which is of course wanted by many, many countries and people. Niger also has petrol, a very high grade of petrol. Not that much, but enough for Niger to survive. On petrol is actually its main source of income. Then Niger is strategically located within West Africa because it's surrounded by all these rebel countries. Now, Niger has had also a special role to play for the French, because the French have had so far about 1,200 soldiers still there, but about what nobody talks about is that the U.S. has three military bases there. Three mm-hmm. military bases and at least 3,000 soldiers. That's why Nuland came personally. And now what I suspect, you know, what I suspect, and this has to do with the Wagner Group boss being killed yesterday in an airplane accident.
Mm-hmm.
Accident. I'm pretty sure it was not an accident. but the fact that he was killed and he was also already going to Africa. He was already in Africa. He was actually filmed in Niger. He wanted to go and look for order in Niger. And this, Putin has not addressed him personally, but he has said less than a week ago, he has said that repeatedly, nobody should interfere in Niger. This is an affair that belongs to Niger and nobody should interfere. So he was actually warning the French, particularly, and ECOWAS, because ECOWAS is NATO, the French, and the U.S. ECOWAS is supported by
mm-hmm.
this. And you know, if ECOWAS interferes, you have NATO in West Africa, in the Sahel, and Putin knows that. So he has warned everybody not to go there, And I could imagine, and I was just thinking of writing something about it now that I can never pronounce his name, the Wagner boss, that doesn't any longer exist. I was wondering whether there is a connection between Wagner, Niger, and Washington, and what this connection is. And it is a very strong connection because Nuland doesn't just travel to Niger from nothing. She could have done that by a phone call. And so there is a very, very good reason for her to be there. These bases, one of them is a drone base, I think.
Yeah, Costa. I read that since 2012, NATO has spent $500 million in military for installations in Niger. That's a $500 million, and the most recent one is the drone port that cost over $110 million. So they're not going to leave, and I don't know how the Nigerians are going to get them out of there, because it's not Vietnam, you know, Ho Chi Minh and the People's War. They could hide in the jungles and the mountains. They would see the Nigerians coming, you know, from hundreds of kilometers away across that vast desert. So it's going to be very, very difficult to get rid of the NATO troops in Niger. I don't know what they're going to do. And the French troops.
Exactly. So this is my take on it. And now this is a new dimension that was just added yesterday. The Wagner Group. There must be a very good reason for the Wagners to be there. And I wondered already when the Wagner team was walking towards Moscow, I was wondering already then whether the U.S. was behind it.
The coup that supposedly Wagner pulled off, tried to pull off.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, his name is Evgeny Prigozhin or something like that. Yeah. Right. He's dead now.
He's dead now, and nobody knows how many are they? 5,000 troops or so. Whether they will continue under whom, it's not clear at this point.
Well, yes. I'm sure that Russia will get some of their best military men to go into and keep it going, because they've got troops in Mali, they've got troops in Burkina Faso, they've got troops in Central African Republic, at least that I know of, and they don't want that's very, very valuable, very, very valuable. Foothold for Russia to have influence and cooperation in Africa. So I don't think they're going to let Wagner, pack up its bags and leave. They're going to make sure they stay in Africa where they are based now.
Sure, but they could include them. They could incorporate them into the Russian army.
That's for sure. Well, but the nice thing about Wagner is it's a fig leaf. It's a fig leaf that it's not the Russian army, so right. it's not diplomatic. It's commercial. So James Bradley and I just did a couple of shows about West Africa, and I'll send you the links. I think you'll enjoy them. And I disparagingly called ECOWAS the ECOWAS members, because Guinea and Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger they're still members, but they've been completely shut off,
including Nigeria. Nigeria is also a member, and they're totally against it. You know, they're not. There's no unit. There's no unifying factor within ECOWAS.
But I called ECOWAS Western Empire's House Negroes. Like they're servants, but really it's just absurd. They're gonna go send black people into Niger to fight black people.
They
all speak Hausa, the lingua franca of West Africa. They're brothers, and France and and the United States are sitting there go spill blood.
They gave him probably directed energy weapons to fight each other.
And then, of course, Mali and Burkina Faso are saying they will, it would be a tandem. They have like an informal defense treaty, and they're going to back Niger. I hope that ECOWAS, I hope they don't pull it off. I mean, but unfortunately, the head of ECOWAS right now is from Nigeria, and he's beating his chest, and we're stationing our troops are on alert, and all this other stuff. It's just, but it's just amazing to see the poorest countries in Africa, the Sahel, the poorest and some of the most beautiful countries in Africa too. If you like the desert, it's just spectacular.
Absolutely, yes.
But it's just amazing to see, man. And they're talking about federation and combining forces. And Guinea has a deep water port in Conakry, so that these four countries could have, there's the Trans-Sahelian Highway. Unfortunately, it does not go to Conakry. It goes to Dakar, who also is another House Negro who wants to send troops to Niger for Macron and NATO. But it's so inspiring. I mean, who would have thought that? I mean, 20, you know what would have happened 20 or 30 years ago? They'd have just sent in some special forces and assassinated the leaders. And that's what France and the United States and Britain would do. They just go in and assassinate the leaders or cause a false flag and a color revolution type event, overthrow like Thomas Sankara from Burkina Faso. He was assassinated. France, I actually have the list of the leaders, the 22 leaders of in Africa that were assassinated, and France does not deny that they assassinated those 22 African leaders. So that's what they've been doing for 70 years. Now they can't, because these guys are organized. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, and Guinea on the west, and Chad on the east, you know, and Central African Republic in the south, although they don't really connect directly. But it's so inspiring, and these guys are socialists. I mean, they're like one of the members of the Burkina Faso government, you know, was saying, you know, I'm a communist, you know, we are going to go back to the days of Thomas Sankara and build schools and hospitals. And so it's, you know, it's really, really, really encouraging.
I was just thinking of Thomas Sankara. You know, I was lucky enough to meet him once, not for very
really. Wow.
Yeah, that was still during my times when I worked in Burkina Faso, and I had an, I forgot what it was. So of course, it was all with water resources and with water, and I had an important decision to be taken So I asked for an appointment with Sankara, and I thought I would get one of his aides to talk to me, which would have been normal and would have been great. But no, he in person received me, and we talked for about half an hour.
Really?
It was one of the most pleasant conversations that with any leader that I've had in all my career. This guy was so humble and so smart. He picked up so much. And, you know, of course, at that time already, and this was in the 80s maybe, at that time already, he was the leader of West Africa to get rid of the CFA. And that may have cost his life.
Well, it cost him his life.
Yeah.
But oh, that's amazing. Well, that's what a story. We'll have to share a beer, and you have to tell me about your meeting with Sankara, Thomas Sankara, one of the great revolutionary leaders. I mean, he's like the Fidel Castro.
Exactly. I called him the Che of Africa.
Yeah, the Che Guevara. Yeah, because he got killed. Castro didn't, so he's actually the Che Guevara. He's actually the Che Guevara of West Africa. That he was from 83 to 87, and
yes.
he led for 4 years and built more houses, more hospitals, and more schools, and more roads in those 4 years than France ever did in the entire West Africa in 150 years of colonialism. It's just unbelievable.
Right.
So
it was a great experience. That's why, not only because of that, but there's an aura about Burkina Faso, which I always liked. It's a very poor country. But and at that time when I was there, you know, hotel accommodations were very few and sparse and far apart and not the greatest. But I always felt well. I always felt well in this city in Ouagadougou.
The current leader of Burkina Faso would correct you and say, "No, we are not poor. We are very rich, but we have been exploited and raped for the last 65 years, and now they want to get rid of the West and prosper like other countries. Venezuela, you know, even though they've been hammered and hammered and hammered, they're getting by. And you know, Bolivia, and they want to repeat some of the success stories that they've seen around the rest of the world. So well, listen, Peter, this has been wonderful. You are an incredible guy. I love having you on the show. You're so full of knowledge, and you're humble, and you explain things well, and I really appreciate you coming on, and we are going to get together and have a beer and talk about Thomas Sankara one of these days. I mean, we're just a TGV ride away from each other. I mean, we really should make the effort.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You're in Geneva. You're in Geneva, and I'm actually pretty far. I'm actually 3 hours from a 3-hour train ride from just to get to the TGV in Paris, but because I'm way out here, and you know. In Normandy, but we are going to meet one of these days. In the meantime, everybody, Peter Koenig, I will put all the links on. I'm going to ask him to send me a few things and get the link that I have for Global Research. He writes incredible stuff, and he writes regularly, and that's his best platform. I'll also put a link to show you where he's been on China Rising Radio Sinoland already 4 times. And so this will be the 5th time. Wonderful friend, wonderful comrade. And thank you so much for being on the show today, Peter.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks a lot. Don't forget to send me the English version back.
Well, I'm going to ask you to, if you can send me that LBJ clip and a couple of, I'll ask you that also. All right.
Okay, we'll do.
Win-win cooperation.
Win-win cooperation.
See you later.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Me on your great show.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.